the boarding of the pirate radio station Radio City. It happened on Monday morning, but it wasn't till Wednesday that our reporter Tom Mangold managed to get on board, where he spoke to one of the resident crew who described what had happened.
Early Monday morning, around about 3:30, we were awoken by a very large tug standing by, and many, many people, more than 15 people, led by three people, two men and a woman. Two of these people I have seen before. These people gave as many excuses for their presence. One of the excuses was that they were putting some men aboard for our own protection. Later it came out that they wanted to immobilize both our transmitters. They did this, and
was any violence used at all?
No, there was no violence used, but they came very close to it. They wouldn't allow us to go into the studio or to various parts of the building. They just pushed us out. I did see one man with a gun, although they did deny this, naturally. And
what's happened since they arrived? Are you living in harmony now?
Well, we've got to, really. We've tried very hard to be friendly with these people. After all, we're grossly outnumbered. All these men are very big, tough men. So we decided to try and be as amiable as possible.
But relations between the two parties didn't stay too amiable. On Friday, a boatload of journalists, Tom Mangold among them, were forbidden to board the fort by the men who'd taken over. But as Paul Elvey, the radio's chief engineer, came off the sea towers onto the boat, he said to Mangold,
"They're much more hostile now than they ever were. We were on friendly terms with them, but now things are much worse than ever. Why, I can't imagine, but they've threatened to cut down the connecting bridge between the two towers, which would be a very severe step, and they've also threatened to chop down our mast. These threats would only be carried out if any people boarded the towers that they didn't want to board the towers."
So this is why reporters were not allowed to go on board today?
That's quite true, yes.
Now, what is the reason for this? What's made them so jumpy?
I have no idea. It's come about since last night. I can't imagine what's instigated this at all.
That item was introduced by Cormac Rigby.
John Tusser raised some of these legal issues with Colonel Gerald Draper, reader in English law at King's College, London.
Colonel Draper, this afternoon the Army Minister, Mr. Reynolds, said in the Commons, "There's no present or foreseeable defence purpose which would require me to exercise control over these forts." Now, the services are often criticised for holding on to land well after they appear to have any use for it. So what's your reaction to this reply?
In my view, the reply of the Minister is completely inconclusive on the vital matter whether the Crown still owns these installations or whether it has purported to abandon them. If abandonment is relied upon, all that one can say is the evidence in favour of abandonment is just not there. There are other acts in relation to the control of these installations, such as the placing of warning navigation lights by the Port of London Authority, which would seem to negative that Her Majesty's government has abandoned interest in these installations, and it is completely irrelevant for the minister to say that he, at the moment, has no defence purpose in mind. Tomorrow, he might change his mind, and I doubt if he would say then that he's not entitled to change his mind.
Now, there's no doubt that they were built by the government and that the government once owned them, is there?
They were put up at considerable expense, the expense of the taxpayer.
Now, I believe it's extremely difficult for an individual to abandon property. So can a government abandon property any more easily?
I do not think the Crown is in a position to abandon property any more easily than the individual and his private motor car. All the evidence at the moment is dissuasive of the conclusion that the Crown has abandoned this property.
Now, you mentioned this question of the Port of London Authority putting up lights on the forts to indicate that they're an obstruction to navigation. Does this therefore imply that the government has any duty to remove these obstacles to navigation?
I do not think the Crown is under any duty to remove them, although there may be some dispute if there was any accident arising out of them. I would refer to the fact that the Minister of Defence for the Royal Navy in July 1964 stated that legal action for trespass against Radio Such was inhibited simply simply because at that time it was outside territorial waters.
Well, it's obvious that the forts don't lie in internal waters, but are they in territorial waters or are they on the high seas?
They are very firmly within the territorial seas of the United Kingdom since the 30th of September 1964, when the Crown, by order in council, made a law to that effect under the powers given to this country under the Geneva Territorial Seas Convention of 1958.
But because they're fixed objects, doesn't this in any way make them offshore islands and therefore subject to a different interpretation?
No, an island is rather a technical matter, and I can assure you that these installations are not what lawyers understand as islands.
Are there any parallels that you can draw between the legal status of North Sea oil rigs?
Yes, there's a very big comparison and a difference. The North Sea oil rigs are built on what we call the continental shelf. The waters above that shelf are high seas, and by a statute called the Continental Shelf Act, and an order in council made thereunder, this country has jurisdiction for all crimes committed on those rigs by virtue of that statute. But I would remind you that those rigs are built in waters that form the high seas, whereas the installations of 390 and radios such were built in waters that are territorial waters since 30 September 1964.
All right, well, suppose a crime of whatever sort is committed on one of these forts. What court has the authority to deal with them?
Well, if it were a serious crime, it would be within the jurisdiction of our senior criminal courts by virtue of an old statute called the Territorial Waters Jurisdiction Act of 1878. If it were a minor summary offence, depending on its nature, it would be within the jurisdiction of magistrates' courts of this country.
But it's been said that these courts aren't clearly within any one county and that therefore they can't therefore come under the authority of magistrates' courts.
That I do not think is a point of any substance. It would be arguable, I think, that any magistrates' court would have jurisdiction for a summary offence committed on one of these installations in the territorial sea. And as to a serious crime, there would be no difficulty at all.
And on these points of jurisdiction over offences on the forts, is there really any substantial difference of legal opinion?
I think not. I think the only differences have arisen have been within the inner workings of Whitehall.
Colonel Draper, thank you very much.
John Chuser was talking to Colonel Gerald Draper.